You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. Tonight on Right on Radio, Ian Graham Leask talks with Brian Freeman, a New York Times bestselling author of psychological thrillers, including the Jonathan Stride and Frost Easton series, about his latest works, The Deep, Deep Snow and Funeral for a Friend. His books have been sold in 46 countries and 22 languages, and he was selected as the author to continue Robert Ludlum's Jason Bourne series.
And I'm Annie Harview. In the last part of the hour, I'll be chatting with Mindy Grayling, a member of the Minnesota House of Representatives for 20 years. She helped found the nation's first state mental health caucus, which successfully lobbied for a significant increase in Minnesota's mental health funding. She has served on the state and national boards of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, and is on the University of Minnesota Psychiatry Community Advisory Council. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right on Radio.
Brian, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, you're there. For some reason, Josh, the engineer, can't hear you, but I can. So,
are we on? Can you hear? You can hear me, okay?
I can hear. How are you doing, man?
Good, excellent.
Yeah, good. Good to have you back on the show.
Yeah, it's been a little while now.
Yeah, it's been a while. I missed you with the Deep, Deep Snow one, which came out. What was that? February.
January even for an ebook. Yeah. It just came out in paperback in October.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Well, we talk a little bit about both of them. So, man, you are prolific. What is going on with you this year?
It has been quite the year for both book launches and writing books too.
Yeah. Well, you're not getting a whole lot of book launches, I don't expect.
Well, all virtual, which actually has been a good thing because it means I've at least had time to stay at home and write. If I actually had to go out on the road and do all these events, that would be a challenge.
Oh, my God. We're going to get flooded with you next year if you've been writing.
It's not like you haven't been flooded with me this year.
Exactly. I mean, this is really amazing. So we've got The Deep, Deep Snow, and then Thief River Falls came out in February, and you did The Bourne Evolution, which is the Robert Ludlum.
Yep, that was July, stuff. And then Funeral for a Friend in September. So.
Yeah, so just an amazing amount of stuff. So this is Ian Graham Leask here. I'm speaking with my good friend Brian Freeman, who is an internationally a New York Times bestselling author of mystery and detective and psychological suspense novels, including Spilled Blood, which won the 2013 ITW Thriller Award for Best Hardcover Novel. Pretty good. His books have been sold in 45 countries and 22 languages, and have appeared as main selections in the Literary Guild and the Book of the Month Club. That doesn't even seem close to what you've been doing lately. That description from your kit, your publishing kit.
I know. I look back on how this all started 15 years ago, and I think, gosh, I was doing a book a year back then. That kind of feels like a vacation at this point.
Yeah, I bet it does. Yeah, and you were. So, are you planning to keep this up?
I've got deals with four separate publishers at this point, and so you know the good thing is they're asking for content, which I love, and they're all very different stories and characters and approaches. So I love the sheer diversity of projects that I've got on my plate. That's kind of what keeps me creatively energized. But at the same time, I think it's an open question. You know, is it three books a year for the foreseeable future, or will I be institutionalized? I think we'll see.
Well, we're all going to need that, I think, pretty soon.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. So tell us, start off with, you know, we'll get to Funeral for a Friend, which is the main focus tonight, and I'll have you read a little bit from that in a minute. But let's talk a little bit about Deep, Deep Snow, which is a standalone. And but I think I'd like to start with just explaining to people, having you explain to people what the Robert Ludlum thing is, you know, and how you managed to get selected, you know, to take over that franchise. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. That was such an amazing honor. It was probably right around 2 years ago that I got a call from my agent, and she said that that Putnam had taken over the Jason Bourne series and done a two-book deal with the Robert Ludlum estate, and they were looking for a new author to take over the Jason Bourne series. And was I interested in, you know, tossing my hat into the ring? And I've been a Ludlum fan my whole life. I can remember reading The Bourne Identity all the way back when it came out in 1980, when I was all of 17 years old. So I said, yeah, let's give it a try. And so she tossed my hat into the ring. And honestly, I don't quite know how the process went after that. It was kind of a black box, which I guess is sort of appropriate for Jason Bourne. But several months went by, and I just sort of assumed they decided to go another way. But then I got another call from my agent in, I think it was February of last year, saying five words I will remember for a long time: Putnam wants you for Bourne. And so I called the editor at Putnam to talk about my vision for how to take this series that, you know, was literally 40 years old and has had so many different iterations, you know, in books and in movies over the years, and bring it into the modern era and kind of reboot and relaunch the whole series. And he loved kind of where I wanted to take it. And I developed a plot concept and wrote some chapters for the estate to take a look at, and they loved that. And so we were off to the races. That was how everything got started.
So tell us a little bit about how you handle a franchise that old. I mean, is Jason Bourne just getting older? I haven't read this one.
It's 40 years old, and the original book, The Bourne Identity, was coming out of the whole Vietnam Watergate era, and Bourne as a hero has a lot of roots in Vietnam. Writing a book featuring this character in 2020, that just wouldn't work unless, you know, you're planning on having him, you know, using a walker and an oxygen tank. I said, you know, I think what we really need to do is kind of go back to the drawing board and reboot the character and the series in modern times, and not be tied to that original backstory, and instead really try to get back to the elements that made Bourne such an enduring, iconic thriller hero. And so I really tried to go back to the roots of who this character was when Ludlum created him, and carry that forward and you know, then reinvent this character in a modern era.
Of course, we omitted to say that Robert Ludlum died. It might be that not everybody knows that. How long ago was it he died?
It was early 2000s. I can't remember if it was 2001, 2002.
And then did he have some books in the hopper that they published prior to taking you on?
You know, what happened was that was around the time that they had the Matt Damon movie franchise starting up. And I think that triggered a lot of new interest in Jason Bourne. And they had Eric von Lustbader, a longtime thriller writer, and I think a good friend of Ludlum's, who took over and wrote a number of Jason Bourne novels. And I think Eric decided he was sort of interested in retiring, and Putnam took over and wanted to go a different way. So that was why they wanted to find someone new to take over the series.
And did you have to study them, or did you read all the books and sort of go back and really pass them out and get a real sense of what his style was?
Yeah, I had obviously read the Ludlum books, you know, many times over the years. I've been a big fan for a long time. And I went back. The first thing I did when this possibility came up was go back and reread Ludlum's Bourne books to really get a feel for the nature of the character and what he was trying to do, and paid particular attention to the Bourne identity, because I feel like that was sort of the core book in which this character came to life. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time looking at how he structured this character and who this character was. And I think that people that know Jason Bourne primarily through the Matt Damon movies may have kind of a different idea of Bourne than you'll find in Ludlum's books. I think that the movies sort of portray him as a little bit more of this, you know, emotionless killer, sort of almost more of a superhero. And that really was not how Bourne comes to life on the pages of the Ludlum novels. I mean, he's much more emotional, fractured. The relationship he has with his wife Marie is really at the heart of the series. And those were the elements that I wanted to bring back. I wanted to really humanize Bourne in my books and kind of get back to the elements that were so were so prominent in Ludlum's version.
I always thought that being a Bond fan, I always thought that Jason Bourne was like an American James Bond in some ways.
Well, I think reputationally that's probably true. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways Bourne has sort of the long-standing enduring quality of being the American hero in the same way that Bond does over in the UK. But, you know, obviously, a very different American versus British style. I mean, Bond is so much more sort of polished and cultured and that's not Bourne. I mean, he's American. He's a little rougher edged, and he really struggles with his personality and his past, which obviously, as someone who has lost his memory, I mean, he's struggling with who he is and trying to understand his identity. And I think that's what makes him a really fascinating character to write.
Well, we should probably keep following this as you work on this and have a show just about this sometime, you know, a few months from now. And
absolutely. In fact, I'm turning in the second of my Bourne books this week, so I just am putting the finishing touches
really?
On
and
it
they
right now.
And they contracted two from you.
Yeah, and it looks like they'll be going back and doing a couple more after that too.
Man,
so
that is just wonderful. So good. All right, so I started reading all the other stuff. I couldn't read everything, but Deep Snow just was just fantastic.
I've had readers say that too. Yeah, that I mean, I'm writing so fast that they're falling behind.
Well, it's I do have you on for most of the books, and I think the Deep Snow is the only one I've missed recently. And we always have a good time with this. But why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about Deep Snow, and then we'll focus on Funeral for a Friend.
Yeah. The Deep Snow came out as an Audible original last year. So it was an audiobook exclusive. It was a fascinating creative experience for me in a lot of ways. First of all, writing, knowing that the book was going straight to audio, it was a different creative process, writing something that you knew people were going to be listening to rather than reading. And this was the first mystery that I'd written that was not only in the first person, but also in a female voice. Yeah. And so it's not really a thriller in the way many of my other books are thrillers. It's really more of a pure mystery. And I love the young sheriff's deputy, Shelby Lake, who is at the heart of this. She's got a great narrative voice, but I really had to work hard to get her to open up to me. It's a really interesting experience writing in the first person and feeling as if Shelby had to kind of reach a level of trust with me as a writer in telling her story. And I felt like initially in the manuscript, she was kind of holding things back from me. And it took a little while before she began to reveal some of the secrets that I didn't necessarily know about her when I started the book. So it was a very interesting creative experience to write. And it's an extremely emotional, intense story. It may be my favorite book of anything I've written. I really love The Deep, Deep Snow. And I did something I've never done before. Recently, I listened to the full audio edition of the book. It's voiced by a wonderful actress named January Lavoie. And typically, I never listen to the audio editions of my books because I hear the prose in my head in a certain way. And it kind of drives me crazy when I hear somebody else doing it. But my gosh, I was so impressed.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was funny. I started looking at that and I thought, I'm not going to have time to finish it before I have to get on to the funeral for a friend. But it really did catch me. And I loved the owl. Got a lot of story that has an owl in it. Very, very good. So would you like to read a little bit from Funeral for a Friend? And we'll talk about that, which is the book that's on stage right now.
Yes, Funeral for a Friend is my latest Duluth-based Jonathan Stride novel. So this will give you a little taste of the book. Stride stood on a cliff of black granite, 60 feet over a raging river. The fullness of the summer forest surrounded him. He knew this place well. It was called The Deeps, where Amity Creek stampeded along Seven Bridges Road like a wild Mustang, swirling in whirlpools and sucking tree limbs into its current before spitting them out in the cold water of Lake Superior. From this cliff, you could take a running leap into the water and swim in the black pool below. He'd done it himself dozens of times as a teenager. He and his best friend, Steve Garski, would shout, jump, fly through the air, crash into the water, and fight the undertow back to the surface over and over. But sometimes, when the rains were heavy, the deeps caught a body and didn't give it back. Sometimes the flooded river held a body down and fed it to the lake. Stride stared into the rapids, which boomed like deep rolls of thunder and erupted in silver waterfalls. He was right on the cliff's edge, where the spray made the stone slippery. "Don't fall," a voice said. Stride turned around. "Don't fall, they'll never find you." A man stood behind him. He was short, no more than 5'6", with a skinny build. He had thinning black hair and wide, staring eyes that looked like the mask of a raccoon. His skin was pale. His hair and clothes were soaking wet. He'd been diving into the swollen creek. Drip, drip, drip. Stride heard the noise in his head again, somehow louder than the violence of the river below him. But it wasn't water he heard. The man on the cliff had a bullet hole in the middle of his high forehead, a perfectly circular black-ringed wound that seeped a ribbon of blood down the man's nose, around his pale lips, and onto his chin, where it dripped onto the stone like chamber music. Blood. That was what he'd heard all along. Blood. Stride's right hand felt heavy. He lifted it and saw that a gun was in his hand, a wisp of smoke trailing from the barrel, a burnt smell in the air. He'd shot this man in the head. The wound was right there in his forehead, but the man still had his eyes open, still had a strange smile on his lips. "You're dead," Stride told the man. The smile on the man's face widened and turned into a mocking, cruel laugh that went on and on. "You have to be dead," Stride insisted. "I shot you." But the man raised his arm and extended a bony, brittle finger at Stride's chest. Stride looked down. His own shirt was soaked in blood, fresh, cherry red blood growing and spreading into a misshapen stain, a mass of blood, the kind of loss no one should survive. And there was a bullet hole in his own chest, ripped through the fabric, right where his heart was. "No," the man told him, still laughing. you're the one who's dead.
Very good. Very dramatic. Very Sturm und Drang going there. Wonderful stuff. So that's the opening to the book. It's a dream.
Yes, yes, yes. Dream. And it will probably come as no shock that that's a dream sequence there, yes.
Yeah. It takes a while to get it into dream because you hide that a little bit in that opening.
Yes, yes.
So let's talk about dreams. You start that out with a dream, and it's interesting to me when we look at dreams and we think of fiction and think of how we develop our fiction from dreams. When you write a dream, it's kind of like a suburb of fiction, isn't it?
Yeah, and honestly, I have always found that my dreams are very kind of parallel to the way I write my books, because the odd thing in my dreams is I am constantly shifting characters and perspective.
Oh, yeah,
in when I dream, I will go from one character to another, and I may start out in one person in the dream, and then suddenly I'm someone completely different inside the same dream. And that's honestly the way I kind of approach my prose as well. I'm looking at the world from multiple perspectives, and that's very true in the Stride books.
Well, this one, you certainly resurrect all your old characters, all his old girlfriends, everybody's resurrected, and you bring them all back and fit them together, and he doesn't get quite as much stage time as I'm used to with him.
That's true. He's a little bit more of a supporting character, and I think that's partly as the series has evolved and more characters have really kind of taken center stage. I think that Stride has let some of the other characters, share that platform with him. But you know, I'm always, when I'm designing a new Stride novel, I'm always looking at what's going on in the lives of the series characters, sort of what's next for them. And I went all the way back to the very, very first book, Immoral, this time around, and I remembered that Stride had a very misbegotten marriage, a second marriage in Immoral, to a woman named Andrea. And I'd never gone back to Andrea again in the series, nine more books, and I'd done nothing with Andrea again. And I felt like that was just a storyline that was sort of sitting there open and needed to be resolved. Mm. And so it just seemed to fit perfectly to bring Andrea back in Funeral for a Friend and deal with the ramifications of kind of how that marriage fell apart.
Mm. No, I think that's very effective. I like that a lot. All the books, all your books are a little bit different. Every time you do one, you seem to bring in some sort of current affair. I think we talked about this last time, in various ways. And here, you know, you've got deadbeat reporters and sleazy politicians, rape, and a lot of internet connection here. Is this more than you've done before in terms of that, of the current editions of things?
You know, I think it's very much in line with how I've approached some of the recent Stride books. I think they do kind of have a little bit of a ripped from the headlines feel to them. The previous Stride book was Alter Ego, and Alter Ego dealt with a film being made in Duluth of one of Stride's cases.
Book,
and
that's a great book.
That was, yeah, and the actor that was playing Stride had some very dark secrets, and that book, I actually turned it in 2 weeks before the whole Harvey Weinstein thing hit in the press. Yeah. So people were asking, you know, did I know something? And it's like, well, no. In this case, it was just a coincidence that it sort of became the first thriller of the Me Too generation. But in Funeral for a Friend, I definitely was inspired by a lot of the storylines and the headlines, and when you look at the politician in Funeral for a Friend and this story of, you know, sexual misconduct going all the way back to his college days, obviously you can't help but think of you know, the whole Kavanaugh issue and all the things that went out, and so I was inspired by that and sort of wove that into the concept of the plot with the idea of kind of exploring all sorts of different puzzles and secrets and issues of memory and how, you know, all these years can kind of dealing with the question of, you know, when all that time has passed, can you ever really find the truth?
Yeah, and of course you get into that old trope, which never seems to get old, and that is that the main character, the cop, becomes a suspect.
Yes. For the first time, it seems like Stride actually crossed a line. You know, this very, very honorable man sort of did something that he really should not have done. But if Stride's going to cross the wrong line, then chances are he's trying to protect someone.
It's so interesting because he has kind of come close before in some of the other books. Like a lot of these sorts of characters, he's not always a good boy, is he?
Well, and particularly if you go back again all the way to the very first book in Immoral, the one of the things that Stride particularly did wrong, without going into any details or spoilers, of course, was actually back in Immoral. So things kind of come full circle a little bit in this book.
So, you know, as you talk about all of these books going back to the beginning, I wonder what COVID and the situation that we're in right now is doing to your readership. Are they rereading your books? Are they going back and reading the first ones? I know you've called for communication with your readers, and I've seen that. I think that's very generous of you. It's because that could end up being a lot of time. Tell me a little bit about your experience with that as an author.
Yeah, I have definitely found that this year. I found, first of all, that I think a lot more people have rediscovered reading generally. I mean, a lot of people have found the books this year because they're staying home more, they have more time, they're looking for different forms of entertainment, and they're looking to the books. But it's just as you say, I've heard from so many readers now that have been going back to rediscover the books, starting at the beginning of the series and reading their way forward again. So that has been, I think, a really positive thing in an otherwise difficult year. I think that, you know, having to not do in-person events, one at least positive is by doing all sorts of virtual events, which we've been doing, it actually gives us a chance to, you know, reach out to readers who are not geographically close. I mean, normally if I'm doing events, it's going to be, you know, in the upper Midwest. Well, now doing Zoom happy hours and Zoom bookstore events and things like that, I can, you know, invite and bring in readers from places I otherwise never would have had a chance to visit and connect with them. And I think that's a good thing. And that's likely to live on well past the COVID days.
Yeah, I hope it does, because it's lovely seeing you on Zoom here. You know, it's you can't be in right here in the studio with us, but here's your face sitting up there. So we're, of course, run out of time, but let's come on again and have a deeper talk about the Bourne evolution, and do that in a couple of months and see how we go with all of that. And
yep, I'd love to do it.
I just wish you all the best of luck. You are just the hardest worker, and you are such a nice man, and you've got a good heart, and you should put these things out. You know, I really respect what you do, and good luck to you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you, Ian.
And thanks for being on the show again. You were listening to me, Ian Graham-Lee, speaking with Brian Freeman about Funeral for a Friend and the Deep, Deep Snow and the Bourne Evolution. See you again soon, Brian.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And now this.
Hi, all. This is Annie with Write On Radio. I'm very excited to be here with you guys. Unfortunately, our guest has not called in for this show yet. So for now, I'll just introduce the book a little bit, a little more about what it's about. I'll be interviewing Mindy Grayling, the author of Fix What You Can, a memoir about schizophrenia and particularly a mother's experience with her son having her son have schizophrenia become onset in his 20s, and then attempting to help him both in her role as a mother and in her role as a lawmaker, both by helping him find career opportunities and also by trying to pass legislature that would help protect him in the future. I'm going to throw on some theme music, chill out, sit back, relax, wait a couple minutes. Hopefully she'll be here very soon. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Hi, this is Annie, your optimistic but also realistic host here on Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM. Since I am not sure if our guest is coming, perhaps she has a family emergency, perhaps she has a snow emergency. I'm still hanging here in the studio. We're practicing social distancing. We've got screens up. We're taking all the precautions. I'm here with my wonderful friend and KFAI mentor, Liz Olds, and we're just going to have a little chat while we wait and see if she shows up. Liz, what have you been reading and writing lately?
What have I been reading? Well, I've been reading a lot of books right on radio. The main one that I've been reading right now is a book called Hymns of the Republic, and it's a book about the last year of the Civil War. Very interesting to me because I'm a Civil War buff. You should see my books, my wall of books about the Civil War. Have I ever shown you a picture of that?
No.
Oh,
I like seeing pictures of your cats, so I'm sure I'd like to see pictures of your apartment.
Yeah, so so that is very interesting to me, and it'll be a fun interview. I can't remember if it's on the... No, let's see. Lee's on the 17th, 24th. I think it's on the 8th of December, but I'm not positive. But anyway, we got lots of interviews, so if you happen to tune in on the 8th of December, you wouldn't be disappointed. So that's what I'm reading is books for Right on Radio. What I'm writing is I'm doing this 12-show series about songs of Broadway.
Yeah.
And I'm working on the script for that. I was trying to record the first episode today. Again, I've recorded it about three times and have had technical difficulties. And we had technical difficulties again today because there's only one CD player in the recording studio that works. So, but writing it, I've had to do a lot of research, and I have learned many, many things writing this series. I'm trying to think of one that I could share with you, but I'm not bringing one up to mind right at the moment. I know one. The theme to Oklahoma was not a medley of orchestral medley of songs from the show. It was just simply an empty stage with a woman churning butter in the middle of the stage, and then Curly, the male lead, comes on singing "Oh, What a Beautiful Morning," and it was quite surprising. It shocked the critics and the audience because they're used to theme songs, you know, big orchestral things, and so this was different. Oklahoma is also considered to be the beginning of the golden age of musicals because it had a story. It's called the book musical. It had a story rather than a pile of songs that aren't connected really in any way to each other. This had a real story, and the songs were connected. Also, Oklahoma is actually a musical about one of the characters is a guy who is a rapist, and there's a murder, and there's he has pornographic postcards, and there's all this stuff in Oklahoma that never anybody would think, because they think it's just this, you know, uplifting musical, and it is. But Rodgers and Hammerstein really did, like in The King and I, too, they took on certain issues of the day, you know, segregation and murder and, you know, things. Mostly issues of the, it's kind of like the same issues we're dealing with today. Racial injustice. South Pacific is full of ideas about racial injustice. There's a song in there called "You've Got to Be Carefully Taught," which is about the fact that, you know, you're not born a racist. You have to be taught to be a racist. And that song was very controversial. And in some productions it was left out, and in other productions it was kept in. So anyway, that's my story about what I'm working on. As you can tell, I'm excited about it.
Do you think, Liz, that the idea of kind of a book-forward musical rather than a songs-first musical opened up the opportunity to, like, make a musical that's more, like, focused on a social issue or focused on a cultural issue? Or do you think that those things just kind of coincided in public arts?
No, I think the first. I think that they had musicals that were just reviews. You know, of songs. They didn't fit together at all. They were just kind of, you know, songs. And then this concept of a book musical, which started with Oklahoma, brought the ability to tell, when you're telling stories, you can approach those issues differently than if you're just singing a song about it, you know.
Yeah.
And again, South Pacific was pretty amazing show in terms of issues around race and and xenophobia and stuff like that. So and the story left room for that. And so I think, you know, you're right. I think that once musicals were doing stories, West Side Story is another one, you know, it's about, certainly about racial issues. And it doing these story musicals definitely opened up the concept of talking about issues of the day.
Cool. Do you have any? I know you've been doing pretty extensive research, reading, listening for this podcast. Do you have any recommendations for someone who's interested in kind of the origin or the sort of history of the book forward musical could look into?
Boy, there's a lot of books that I read, and I can't remember the title, but you know, if you go to Google or search engine and search Broadway musicals, and then a bunch of stuff will come up, and the books will come up. They're mostly titles like the Broadway musical, blah, you know.
And, yeah.
And, you know, and some of these stories are just amazing. And once you, it's kind of like the Civil War in a sense that once you've read a bunch of books about the Civil War, the same stories keep cropping up.
Yeah.
And it's the same way with Broadway musicals. You read four or five books and the same stories keep cropping up, you know. And,
yeah.
And so I'm afraid I don't have titles, but.
That's okay. That's okay. For being on the spot, I think you're giving great analysis.
Oh, thank you.
For those of you listening at home, if you have internet available to you on KFAI.org, you can listen to Liz's other podcast, The Broadway Project, for free. It's just there on the site, and you can listen to it. It has premiered, so that's something cool.
Actually, it hasn't yet.
It hasn't premiered yet?
No.
Gosh, I messed
having
up.
All these, we're having all these technical difficulties. I tried to record it at home at my home studio, and the narration sounded awful. And then I tried to input my CDs or my music through the computer onto Hindenburg, and that sound was awful. So I came in here to do some recording in our production studio, and we only have one CD player, and you know, it's just, I'm going crazy, but we'll get it up there eventually. I have no doubt.
Yeah. If you didn't donate during the last member drive, you can think about that for the future, because as those of us here in the studio know, this is truly all-in community radio. Most of us are not getting paid to be here. We're doing this on a volunteer basis because it enrich our lives in some ways. A lot of us make our shows and podcasts using equipment in the studio that we wouldn't be able to afford, have space for, or both otherwise in our own homes. And it's really a wonderful institution. And you can tell from the variety of programming available on KFAI in numerous languages and on numerous topics that it really opens up options for people
to have a creative output that other people are going to interact with.
So what are you working on, Annie?
I personally just wrapped up a couple book reviews that I submitted to local magazines, not yet to be named. I reviewed a couple books that I was really excited about this year. One is Milk, Blood, Heat by Dante Almonez, who's a fabulous first book author who writes in Florida about Florida. And it's a really cool collection of stories that take place in a shared world in Florida. And I think they're just remarkable stories because they take the same scene, look at it from very different ages, social demographics, viewpoints. And I just think that I usually want to write a review because I love the book. I've never read a book that I hate and thought, "Oh, I want to write a smash of this." I always want to dig into the details of what I think makes a book important and what someone could get out of it, so that if they read the review and it speaks to them, that's great, and they can go look for that book and pick it up. And I really liked Milk, Blood, Heat both because of the perspective it brought and because there are romantic relationships in the book that are great and not so great, but it's so much a book about friendship. Like the first story, which is the titular story, as I hate to say, and it is about this friendship between two young girls who one is white, one is black, and the white girl meets an untimely young death. And the black girl kind of lives with the consequences, and it discusses the ways that they're the same, but also the ways that society views them very differently, in ways that I thought were really eloquent and really well done and really shown rather than told. And I'm just very excited about this book, and I can't wait for people to read it. I'm trying to work myself back into more of a routine of writing fiction, so I'll set aside time and just let myself write. I'll just let myself, like, throw the silly string. So I don't really know what's coming of that, but it's something that I haven't been able to do for a while. And it's nice to be able to pick that up. That's always a relationship that I've had with drawing, but I haven't had as much with writing. So it's been very nice to kindle that back. And like everyone on this show, I'm reading constantly for this show and also sending galley requests. For those of you who are either new listeners or aren't aware, we send all of our own book copy requests, develop relationships with publicists completely on our own, write our own interviews, produce our own interviews. When I pre-record something, I spend painstaking amounts of time, like going in with a metaphorical tweezer and taking out all of my ums and pauses. So that's actually been a really nice thing to have during the pandemic and the quarantine, that I can spend my time doing something that I find really enjoyable and fulfilling, and that I have Josh, Liz, Dave, Ian, etc. To really encourage me and hold me accountable as I go through this. I hope to someday go full podcast the way Liz is, but for now it's really great to have this communal show that we can together write on and record on. And if you're out there and you're an author and you'd be interested in having your book on the show, we do have contact information on kfai.org where you can pitch us. You can go direct to us. You don't have to go to some kfai at sitting in someone's empty inbox forever.org. You can go directly to us. So
And I just want to repeat something we said in the calendar, which is I'm trying to get more items for the calendar. Sometimes Rain Taxi has a ton of items, but sometimes they only have one or two, and I'd like to have a longer calendar than that, and I'd also like to provide people with an outlet for their calendar items. So I'm going to give you that email address a couple more times here, so grab a pen. It's worcalendaritems@gmail.com. Now, items has an S on the end, so it's worcalendaritems@gmail.com. And please send us your events and have the info to me by Monday, the day before the show, because that's when I do the calendar. And you know, please send us your events, because we just want to get the word out about writing things and things, places where people can go to hear people read or to learn about writing or whatever. So send us those events.
Yeah, to piggyback off what Liz is saying, we here in the studio really want to, we're right with KFAI on wanting to cultivate a creative community here in the Twin Cities, and not just to sit here on the top floor of the Bailey Building in front of those fuzzy microphones and tell you what to read and what not to read. We'd love to hear your thoughts and input and what you want to see and where you want to see us.
La la la.
Yes, this is.
I'll keep talking.
Yes.
We are, unfortunately, our guest did not make it today. So we're kind of filling in with our ideas and your freedom of writing. I was talking to my writing coach yesterday, and we talked about practice. We talked about the spiritual nature of writing. For, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter if you're what your religious background is. The spiritual aspect of writing is a great thing to realize, to have a practice, to try to make it to your desk every day and put your butt down in the seat, as they say. I'm learning, you know. I sometimes, the thing about this Broadway show thing is that, you know, I've been working on a memoir, and it's hard, and it's a slog, and you know what I mean if you've written a memoir, even if you've thought about writing a memoir. And writing this Broadway thing is a lot of fun. And I said to my writing coach yesterday, I don't feel like I'm writing because I'm having fun. And she said, oh, no, Liz, that's writing. You know, writing can be fun sometimes.
That's really wonderful.
Yes, yes, yeah. It is. It's getting fun, and mm-hmm. even the memoir is kind of, it's pushing its way to enjoyment.
I've read Liz's memoir, just so everyone knows, but my lips are absolutely sealed until she is ready to share it with the world. And just thank you, everyone, for listening tonight. This has been Write On Radio on KFAI FM and streaming live on the web at kfai.org. Even though our host couldn't make it, maybe it's the weather, maybe it's something else. Who knows? We'll catch her around sometime. And it was really lovely to catch up with dear, dear friend of the show and backbone of the show, Liz Olds. stay tuned. Up next, you have Bonjour, Minnesota. Have a wonderful night. Thank you.
Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI, 90.3 FM HD, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Online and archived at kfai.org. Radio without boundaries.